Good morning, Mr. Chair.
How's your time this morning?
I'm at your service, sir. I'm at your service, sir.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to change the agenda here. I see there's a number of folks I suspect are here for honoring Dr. Soboloff. And with the committee's approval, we'll take you all first. That's House Bill 217. Who's presenting on this one? Sir, please come forward. Identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Senator Chairman Dyson, Senator Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Willikoski. Good to see all of you so bright and early this morning, having watched you on TV most of the night, but it wasn't you all in session. I suspect you were busy doing other things, but it's great to be here. My name is Sasha Ivan Soboloff. I'm one of four children who came as a result of my mother from Heidelberg, Genevieve Soboloff, and Dr. Walter A. Soboloff, who passed a couple of years ago at the ripe old age of 102. Fellow Mason brother, good to see you, and often track all of the things that you do, and I somewhat stand, as I've always been, at the knee of my dad all the time that I was growing up, and it's very reflective at this moment that you hear that where the Federal Building is today, there was a baseball park, and his dad's church was right across the street from there. And my younger brother and I would sell hot dogs at the baseball games, being fundraisers there, but most of the time, I learned a discipline from my dad, as most of you learn from your moms and dads. Running bulletins, my task as a young man was to clean the church, shine the pews up, make sure the floors are there. And so while all my friends were out there playing baseball and having a great time polishing the cross, cleaning the church up. And looking back on a reflective thing, I happened to be principal here in Juneau in the early 80s, the late 90s. And I used to sneak away, because they would give us a one-month hiatus from our administrative jobs, to Tenneke, which is near here. And Dad and I would have cooking contests, and we'd have different kinds of, if you cook lunch, I'll cook dinner.
Endless solitaire.
endless games of solitaire, and once in a while we would play Old Maid, but That was father and son kind of thing. And one early morning, I was just finishing a breakfast, and I heard a knock at the door. And as the obedient son got up to answer the door, I saw these three gentlemen standing there, and they asked if Walter was here. I said, yes, he is, and showed these gentlemen into the little house that we have in Tenneke. And they said, Walter, I'm not knowing who these gentlemen are. They happened to be the Rockefeller brothers. John D. and his two younger brothers were visiting, and they son knew that Walter lived in Tenneke, and they were there to have a social time with him. And I just shook my head, and I said, you know, this guy that we call our dad is at so many different levels that he was an incredible kind of a leader. So it's quite an honor to have the opportunity to come and speak about this gentleman that you knew as Dr. Walter Soboloff. We all knew him as Dad. We know that he reached and touched many lives. He had a legacy, and one of the things that he would tell me about when I was in seminary, it would take him a month to go from Angoon to Dubuque, Iowa, which is in the middle of the United States, and he would take a month to get to Seattle. Actually about 2 weeks. Then he would hitch the rails from Seattle to Portland. Then he would hitch the rails, meaning he didn't pay, but he rode with the bums. This was at the height of the Depression. And he would ride 4 days on the rails out of Portland to Dubuque. going at a time when most of us, we weren't even a twinkle in his eye back then, but he at his age, at the tender age of early 20s, was seeking education to better the people that he touched. And that's exactly what he came to when he returned to Juneau and led many things that touched all of our lives. And I'm quite sure that if you go to Google and you Google his name, the guy's everywhere. We've been blessed with the opportunity to when I miss him, of course I miss him all the time, but if I want to hear him again, I pull up YouTube or Vimeo, and there he is speaking about some things that are really down to earth. And it's quite an honor to have this opportunity to come and testify on behalf of recognition of November 14th, which is his birthday, to come and show that there are gracious leaders. He never was one to go out there and beat the drum and say, me. He was all about spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ and working with young people. And he would often talk, and I remember him saying this to the Rockefellers, and they were laughing and having fun. And he said, "Well, John, have you gone to church more?" He never failed to bring that character part of your spiritual development, which is at the forefront. So I'd like to thank the committee. I'd like to thank each of you for being willing enough to support this small gesture of naming this opportunity to celebrate the birthday of Dr. Walter Sobolev. Thank you very much for your time and opportunity.
Questions or comments? Sir, younger brother.
Yes, I'm Walter Sobolev, Jr. And I can't add to anything Sasha said.
Well, I can, but thank you, and please stand by. Are there other folks here who'd like to testify? Please come forward, ma'am.
Sorry, I had to argue with Ross Soboloff. Maybe he should come out here before me. I am Kimberly Strong. I'm an ANS Executive Committee woman, and I have served at A&B and ANS Grand Camp for a good number of years under the tutelage of Dr. Soboloff. And I have had plenty of conversations with him. He actually performed the marriage ceremony for my mother and father. He came to Clukwan, which is my hometown village, and was there as a Presbyterian minister at the time my grandmother was alive, and really led our community in Christianity. But he was more than a minister, and he was very much a leader in Southeast Alaska, and then all the way up into the north and down to the south. And no matter where you went across the country or across the state, if you came across Reverend Soboloff, you are more than likely going to get a letter from him seeing how you're doing, checking in on you to lift your spirits, or just ask you, as his son Sasha has said, have you gone to church lately? Have you read the scripture? And his heart was very much with all of the people that he served. And I had the privilege of visiting with him over in Tenneke. I was running for the House many years ago, and Reverend Soboloff opened his doors and guided me and you know, gave me advice. And not too long later, somebody from the opposite party than what I was running for came, and he did the same thing. And he was not a person who chose sides. He really encouraged everybody to do the best that they could, and he tried to help lift everybody. And it didn't matter what, for us, which clan, which political party, which family or which race you came from. It only mattered that you, he encouraged you to lift your station in life, improve the life of yourself, your family, your community. He gave countless hours and dedication to, I think, the entire state and beyond. And so I'm asking for the support for Dr. Walter Soboloff Day. And I also, you know, talk to him about, everybody calls you Dr. Soboloff. All the time I'm growing up, I knew you as Reverend Soboloff. And what do you think about being called doctor? Because I think Reverend is a higher station than doctor. And he just smiled at me and said it was okay. People will call him what is comfortable for them. So I just, again, wanted to say that I know that he would be marking down the amount of time I spoke on his behalf, and he would not want me to keep going on. But Gunathchish, thank you.
Thank you.
Questions, comments? Anyone else like to speak? Please. You can come up, too, if you'd like.
Hi, my name is Susetna King. I come from Angoon, a little village south of here. And my parents are John and Teresa Howard, and they were friends with Walter and his late wife. And in the summertime, we would go on our skiff and go over and visit, usually right around the 4th of July. And there was always these talks that we had that he would have. He'd make kind of like special time for us kids after visiting with our parents and stuff like that, and just ask questions, always asking questions. And I remember this one time we sat down to eat, and he asked if one of us kids wanted to pray. And my brothers, they were a lot quiet, and so I volunteered to pray, and I said it really fast, and then we ate. And his wife said it was a good thing that one of us volunteered, because if we didn't volunteer, we'd still be sitting there praying, because he'd pray for everybody. And one of the times that we went to go race during the 4th of July, I didn't race, and he asked why, and I told him, I said, because I always beat everyone. And then he looked at me and he goes, what if someone would have beat you this time? And I said, I probably would have come back and try and beat them. He goes, that's good. That's good to know. And then he said, it's always good to let other people win so they feel good about themselves. And that conversation kind of went over my head. And then when I got older, I realized what he said. And the last time I interacted with him was at the AMB A&S convention down in Ketchikan. And just like all of you guys, you know, you work really hard. And in that convention, oh my goodness, it would go to like 10, 11 o'clock at night. And if you have somebody in your camp running, you're working till 1 or 2 in the morning. And I was sitting down, and we had a luncheon, and he goes, come have a seat. So I went and sat by him, and he goes, everyone's asking what you're running for. And I looked at him, and I said, what? And he goes, everybody's asking what you're running for. I said, could I be honest with you? Because and he goes, no, lie to me. And we started laughing. And I said, after these 3 days and 3 nights, I said, I'm running for the door. And he looked at me. He goes, but you've learned a lot. I said, yeah, I've learned a lot. I said, I've learned how to be nice. And And he goes, "That's good, that's good, you learned that." He goes, "Because it's a hard thing to do when you're put into leadership, is to take that role and, you know, be there for everybody who wants everything." And I'm sitting there, and he goes, he looked at me, and he was real serious, and he goes, "I'm going to be serious with you now." And I said, "All right." And he goes, "You're not here by mistake. You're here for a reason. And if you don't put yourself first, and I always put people first, then things come back to you." And he's not somebody I knew outside of the relationship that my parents them brought us to. He's actually bigger than I knew who he was. And if you were fortunate enough for him to cross your path, it made you want to be better. There was something about him that he never said, "You have to do this, you have to do that." He gave you something to make you want to be better. And that's how I feel about him. And the first time I testified, I cried because it was personal. And I'm sure he's in the room, because I was like, I can't cry. And I know he's here. I know he's in the room. And very, very proud of his kids. The first time I saw them without their dad, it's tough to see. It's tough to, because in the Native community, we see him everywhere. His presence. I mean, it's hard to explain, because you know you're going to be okay when you see certain people in the room. And with him being gone, it's hard. Thank you.
Questions, comments? Ma'am.
Thank you. Good morning. It's good to be amongst you.
What's
this
name,
morning?
Please?
My name is Paulette Marino.
Thank you.
I'm the past president of Alaska Native Sisterhood Sitka Camp Number 4. And I'm here this morning as a member of the Alaska Native Sisterhood. And with my sister, who is also a grand officer, she's a grand officer in the sisterhood, and I know that Dr. Walter Soboloff and Reverend Soboloff seen something in her and encouraged her, as he's done many people. And I believe that it's a working of the soul, a working of the character, that he seems to be able to shape and mold. Today I'm here to speak, as you have this moment in history, to honor an individual. There are times in centuries that come that there is born of the most humble birth men and women who do great things. They just do it by hugging God, I believe, and being very close to our Creator. As you honor him, or as you choose to honor him this day, you're sending a message out not only to Juneau, Southeast Alaska, that we've had the honor to call him our own, but also amongst the nation and the world, because you'll be honoring a man who's not only achieved in the fields of education and inspiration, but the most common field, that of a spiritual field. You will be lifting up a spiritual leader, one who has guided many people on many different paths. And what higher calling could there be? What greater honor could they be? So the young children and those that are coming up, and even the elders amongst us, as they see this day, November 14th, that he had come into this world, they will continue to see that day as a time to celebrate their communion with our Heavenly Father, their communion with their families, their communion with their people, their communion with the human race, but also that opportunity, as my fellow Alaska Native Sisterhood member has said, the opportunity to look at our own selves and to raise up and stand a little straighter, to make good decisions, to be of good mind, to be of good character, to be kind, to be gentle, and to challenge yourself in intelligence, to do the things and say the things, even if you're the only one in the room amongst thousands that are difficult at times, to have courage. So today it's an honor to speak, it's an honor to be here, and to just share that this great moment in history is so much greater than we can even tell right now, because you will be lifting up a spiritual leader. You will be lifting up a man of humble birth, a man who lived well into his hundreds, and through a century, day by day, letter by letter, through the legacy of his children and grandchildren and those yet to come, has planted a seed, truly planted a seed of faith, of love, and of hope. Gunashish, thank you.
Thank you.
Well said.
Anyone else like to speak? Well, I'm going to indulge you all's time and tell me a few stories from Walter. History and faith are pretty important to me. And when I got here, literally 18 years ago, I wanted to meet him. And I met Walter, or Albert Kokesh, knew that I think, what, nephew? Yeah. And he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't introduce me. He kept saying he wouldn't. It didn't happen. And one day when I was in the house, I looked up and there he was sitting behind me. And so we got introduced during at ease and began a friendship. It was an utter delight to me. I might add that in addition to the many things he did, he translated much of the Bible into Tlingit. And I hope that's still in use and still in print. Told me a fun story. So, as you all know, the coastal Tlingits had a trade route, I think up the Taku to the interior Tlingit. And it was lots of folks and goods going back and forth. So a young Tlingit guy trading with the whites that were here got a little window. And it wasn't very big, I think. 16 inches by 8 or something, and he backpacked it over the Taku to, to the interior, and he traded it for some great treasures, whatever it was, and they'd never seen a window before. And so the only structure that they had that was kind of big enough to put or stout enough to put this window in was a bathhouse. And he said that to this day, the word for window in Tlingit is eye of the bathhouse. Is that true? Yeah, so I always thought that was charming. A few years ago, the attorney general here was a guy named Talis Colbert. And Talis and I were visiting, and I mentioned that I had gotten to be an acquaintance, if not a friend, Dr. Sobolov. And he got all choked up. I said, hey, what's going on? This is the attorney general. And he said, Dr. Sobolov led me to faith. And I had a little time, so he and I went out in the parking lot, jumped in my old rattletrap pickup, went out to his trailer house out there by the creek, and I watched these two men reunited and cry together. And that was pretty neat. He said something else to me that was in, and this will sound like preaching, but he said when he grew up, every Tlingit child knew what good behavior was. They knew that bad behavior was a shame to you, to your family, and to community clan, and so on and so forth. And he said, by and large, that's gone. You know, it's gone in the last 40 years or so. And I suspect that's true. And to all of you who have a position of influence within the community, I would really encourage you, if you haven't been, to do what's possible to recover those values. And they're not just all Christian. There's many things in the Tlingit culture that are very, very admirable that he was proud of. And also, for the first 10 years I lived in Juneau, when I had this job, I lived on the Princeton Hall. And that was a classic wooden yacht built in Sitka, I believe, by students there. And the Navy commandeered it. It was built before World War II. The Navy commandeered and made a patrol boat and had a 20-millimeter cannon on the bow and some depth charges on the stern. But after the war, it went back to being the Presbyterian's mission boat. And Walter spent lots of summers and maybe more traveling around the southeast on that old boat. So Walter was just delighted to see the boat again and recount lots of stories about it. He had an amazing sense of humor and so on. When he finally was confined to a wheelchair, you know, and I was visiting one of the times right out here on the steps, and he just said, well, he said, I've had these old legs a long time, and they're kind of quitting on me. Doesn't that sound like Walter? The other thing, it's really just an aside, but history, and particularly history here and the maritime tradition of Alaska's Southeast Native people have always intrigued me. And but there was a lot of trade here, and it's kind of not known and perhaps shouldn't be publicized, but also slavery was fairly common. And he said he was still seeing slaves here in Juneau in 1915. And, you know, most of that's gone, and many of the spiritual Christian leaders in the area 100 years ago and more were, you know, fighting against that. And anyways, I was inspired by your father. Probably still am, and I'm delighted for this opportunity. Any else want to speak or testify? Comments from the committee? Senator Giesel?
You're asking for a motion,
Mr. Chairman? No, I, okay. First of all, before I just comment.
Senator Coghill?
I didn't know him that well. I had met him. I think his smile was certainly infectious, so... I just wanted to thank the family. I know a little bit about what it's like to live in the legacy of somebody else's name, and it's an honor. And so I appreciate that. The other thing is having a day will not only remember a man's life, but I think it will continue to be the challenge to our lives. And I think this is going to be a good thing for this area, especially who was so deeply, deeply blessed by his life. I'm encouraged. It'll actually encourage me to serve better. So I think for many of us, we'll take great encouragement from it. But I took great encouragement from the testimony today. Thank you.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am happy to make a motion to move House Bill 217, version 28, LS0932/uniform from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Objection? Seeing none, House Bill 217 is passed in committee. We'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record, I'm sorry, with the scheduling problems here, you can stay there, but I'm going to have Quinlan Steiner. He's up for reconfirmation as public defender. Can you hear us, Quinlan?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. I assume you survived the House interrogation?
Yes, I did so far.
Oh, good. Well, you've got an impressive resume and, from my perspective, an impressive record. But please tell us a bit about yourself and why you'd like to continue in this job.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. I've just completed my second term as public defender. This will be my third four-year appointment, if I'm confirmed. My entire legal career now has been spent working for the Public Defender Agency and in public service. It's work that I consider rewarding. I've talked to people many times about how I enjoy going to work every day, and every day that continues to be true. I suppose if someday that's not, I may voluntarily give it up. But one of the things that motivates me about this work is working to ensure the fairness and credibility of the criminal justice system. And on behalf of indigent defendants, it's rewarding, it's compelling, and it's something that needs to be attended to on a daily basis. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions if you'd like.
Questions from the committee? Well, Quinlan, I have certainly enjoyed working with you, and I think I speak for the committee members that when there are issues that are within our purview, which is changing statutes and affecting budgets, I think the legislature, and particularly this group, are particularly interested in being helpful. And if you see that there are barriers in the process that keeps you from accomplishing your mission and indigent people from getting justice, please let us know. And providing a fair justice system for everyone is a high order of responsibility for business. Any other questions or comments? All right. Senator Coghill.
Just a comment of gratitude. I think I just want to say this not only to him but publicly that as a man who watches out for the public and defending them, many times we make rules here that hold them accountable, but it's also true that they are responsible for holding us accountable as far as the rules go, and I think Quinlan's done a good job. And so thank you, Quinlan, and I'm going to be a recommendation to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for Quinlan? All right. Pardon the adjustments in the schedule here, but these folks are scurrying around. We also have Kathleen Frederick from a Chief Administrative Law Judge, Office of Administrative Hearings, for confirmation. Can you hear us, Kathleen?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for serving, being willing to serve. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and why you want to serve.
Well, I applied for the position of Chief Administrative Law Judge because I felt it was a good fit with my background and experience. So let me tell you a little bit about my experience. I've been an attorney for 30 years, and during that time, I've handled a wide range of civil matters. And one of the things that attracted me to this position was the fact that the Office of Administrative Hearings handles a wide range of cases. There's basically 60 categories of cases. And I just enjoy the intellectual challenge of mastering new areas of law. So that was an attraction for me. I have also litigated cases for over 20 years before administrative agencies and in state and federal courts. So I'm familiar with the adjudicative process. On behalf of various clients, I've drafted and reviewed legislation in various positions I've held, and while I was with the Alaska Public Offices Commission, excuse me, as a commissioner, we revamped our statute. So I had familiarity with that aspect of the job. I have trained and mentored attorneys and support staff for more than two decades. And because of my service on APOC, I have familiarity with the executive branch ethics, which is a component of this job, as well as experience from the adjudicative side of administrative proceedings. Over the years, I've had management and supervisory experience. I managed a boutique law firm for 9 years, and I've held various board positions over the years. And another component of this position that I felt was a good fit for me was there is a mediation component. I've been involved in mediation for about 15 years, initially as an attorney, and then after I got my certificate in mediation from Pepperdine, I then applied and was accepted by the Alaska court system as a contract mediator, and I did that for 3 years until I accepted my current position and it was deemed a conflict. Finally, I've raised two children as a single mother and managed a busy law practice. So over the years, I've really been able to hone my time management skills, and I typically look for the most efficient way of doing things. So those are my background and experience. As far as personal characteristics, I think everyone who knows me would say that I am hardworking and I take great pride in my work, and that's something that I would bring to this position if confirmed. Last but not least, I must admit that I love a challenge, whether that challenge is dog mushing at 50 below or running a half marathon. So one of the attractions to this position was that it appeared to be challenging. The breadth of cases and the volume of cases heard on an annual basis contribute to that challenge. It is seemingly complex from what I've reviewed, and I enjoy complex things. It's like a big, giant jigsaw puzzle to me. And as Chief Administrative Law Judge, I would have a role in leading the Office of Administrative Hearings and finding ways to make that office as efficient and as effective as possible. And that's exactly the type of challenge I enjoy. Last but not least, I want to say that, you know, I've certainly been honored to have been appointed by Governor Parnell to this position. And if confirmed, I will do my best to be an outstanding Chief Administrative Law Judge for the state.
Thank you. Questions, comments about Kathleen? Kathleen, you probably heard my earlier comments to Quinlan, but indeed, if you see things that are within our purview that we can do to help the process, and please let us know. And it's my hope that in addition to the challenge that you received, that you'll also get satisfaction and some days at least go home knowing the world's a little better because you're there doing your job. Thanks again for your willingness to serve. Any other questions, comments? All right. In accordance with AS 39, period 05, period 080, and AS 46.64.010, the State Affairs Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointments be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. This does not reflect an intent of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. I might add it does indicate my commitment to having both these folks confirmed. All right. Now we'll go back to Senate Bill 80. Mr. Barnhill, sorry for the delay and for all of you who had to sit through the hopefully not terribly boring part of the meeting.
Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration, and no apologies necessary. It's an honor to take time for you to consider those three individuals. Before you, Mr. Chair, if I might, it's SB 30. And in response to committee questions, we did submit this morning some responses, and I'm happy to step you through those if you'd like, or take questions right away. I'm at your disposal, sir.
Well, I got what appears to be an excellent answer to some of the questions that came up. given the pressures this morning, some of which have been unexpected. I haven't had a chance to read them, but be helpful to me if you would reiterate the questions we ask and summarize your answers.
Happy to do so. So, Mr. Chair, first question is, what is the long-term expectation of growth in the defined benefit plans and the investment earnings assumption, Mr. Chair, that's adopted by the Alaska Retirement Management Board is 8% per year. The second part of that question is, what will the defined benefit plans look like if the state received an average of 4, 6% and 8% return on its investments? And so I'm assuming that the question includes in that a long-term return of 4%, 6%, and 8%. At the 8% rate, which is what we have an unfunded liability as of the FY12 actuarial valuations of $11.9 billion. I will add that the Alaska Retirement Management Board will be considering at its next meeting at the end of April the FY13 actuarial valuation, and at that time that $11.9 billion figure will be updated somewhat, and we're expecting it to remain just about the same, maybe increase a little tiny bit. If the unfunded if the rate of return assumption was decreased in half to 4%, which is considered by some to be what's called a riskless rate of return, and there's been considerable discussion throughout the country about what is the appropriate rate of return assumption for defined benefit pension plans, and there is a school of economists that suggests that 8% is much too high and that pension plans should adopt a 4% or something in the range of a riskless rate of return. That would roughly double the unfunded liability, so we would go from about 12 to 24 billion.
Over what period?
So if we adopted that as an assumption, that would immediately double the unfunded liability.
The assumed.
Yes.
Yes.
And if the assumed rate of return was in between that at 6%, then the unfunded liability would be roughly in between the 12 and the 24 or $18 billion.
Wow, that's startling.
The assumed rate of return assumption in the actuarial calculations has the biggest impact of just about any of the many actuarial assumptions that are used to prepare the actuarial valuation every year. The next question.
Questions, comments? Please continue.
What is the most current breakdown of costs between health care and other pension costs for Alaska's retired public employees? And in answering that, we answered for both the public employees and the teachers' retirement system. Looking at just the unfunded liability, pension unfunded liability is 69.4%, and health care liability is 30.6%. To add a bit more detail to that, Mr. Chair, because you asked for costs, in the last CAFR Comprehensive Annual Financial Report dated June 30th, 2013, the breakdown in costs for that fiscal year between pension and health was just over $599 million in pension benefits and just over $370 million in health benefits for the public employee system. And then for the teachers' retirement system, the breakdown was just over $380 million in costs in the form of pension benefits and approximately $121 million in health benefits for the teachers' retirement system for FY13. Question three, Mr. Chair, is please provide a graph with two trend lines, one being the smooth rate of return compared to a trend showing the fluctuations in Alaska's historic rates of return. And we provided a chart that shows that. So there's three charts here. The first chart shows the fairly volatile rate of return across a period ranging from, it looks like, 1989 through 2014. That's the blue line. You can see it goes up and down with some frequency. And then a rolling five-year annualized return, that's the red line, and you can see it trending in the late 1980s from 16% down to 8%, sort of bouncing between those through 2000, and then you can see the red line going down as a result of the 2001 dot-com collapse, and then trending back up, and then down again for the 2009 Great Recession, and then over the last couple of years, that five-year return is starting to creep back up towards the 8% assumed rate of return. And then the next charts show PERS-TERS returns versus Standard & Poor's 500 over the same time period. And you can see they track fairly closely. At least the trend is similar, and that's primarily a result of our pension fund's exposure to equity investments. 60 to 70% of the portfolio is equity. And then finally, on page three, we see a 75-year chart on the S&P 500. So you've got the blue line, which is the most volatile line. That's your annual returns. Then you've got the green line, which is a five-year rolling, and then the red line, which is a 10-year rolling. Question four, Mr. Chair, is if the investment rates go down, would the system proposed in SB 30 provide lower risk for the state than the current defined contribution plan? I think the first thing to note before I get to our answer is that if we were in the in the context of SB 30 to assume a lower rate of return than 8%. And I probably ought to have Mr. Keel address this, but I'm going to speculate that that plan is built on the assumption of an 8% rate of return. And so if you don't have an 8% rate of return, then the plan may not pencil out fiscally. But I'll let Mr. Keel speak to that directly. I think I'll leave it at that. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions, comments, Mr. Barnhill's testimony.
Question five, if one tier of the defined benefit plan took a disproportionate amount from the retirement plan, how would this affect the other defined benefit tiers? And, you know, the way we compute unfunded liability is across each of the defined benefit tiers. So if, for instance, tier one for the public employee system consumed a disproportionate amount of resources, the system as a whole would reflect an unfunded liability. One way that could be done is, for instance, if the mortality assumptions proved to be incorrect and tier one retirees began living, for instance, 10 years longer than projected, then an experience study at some point by the actuary would show that people are living longer than expected. There would be an update to the mortality table, and then a corresponding unfunded liability for the system as a whole would be added to the valuation. Would it affect the defined contribution tier? And the answer is no. Question six, will the unfunded liability decrease with more employees in the system? Mr. Chair, the unfunded liability is computed with respect to every single employee. So adding new employees is not going to impact that. A new tier of employees, of defined benefit employees, may over time prove to meet actuarial assumptions or not meet actuarial assumptions, or even, for that matter, exceed actuarial assumptions. But it's not going to impact the existing unfunded liability associated with the current members of the plan. Question seven, what number does the administration use to calculate investment returns? And that's the 8%. And question 8, please provide a graph that shows the effect of SB 30 employee contributions and employer contribution. And we have provided a chart. I'm not sure that that directly addresses the committee's question, but it's this chart. It's got the yellow bars that the actuary has submitted last year, and then in the prior version of this bill, SB 121. So we've provided that. Hopefully that will. If it doesn't meet the committee's current concerns, we can go back and request additional information. I will say, and I did share this with the sponsor of the bill, these calculations were done last year, and the model was built on the previous version of the bill, SB 121. And so these, in fairness, I think these actuarial calculations are getting somewhat stale. And to the extent that there's a future for this bill, it probably warrants updating both the model and the calculations.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Using the investment, the 8% investment return that the administration, the actuary, and the ARM board use, does this bill have a positive or negative fiscal note?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, our fiscal note is indeterminate. And the reason, primary reason why it is indeterminate is it reflects the inherent uncertainty that exists in any defined benefit plan. I will say that the sponsor has gone to great lengths to eliminate certain types of uncertainty, particularly with respect to health care costs. And I will recognize and give credit where credit's due in that respect. Unfortunately, in any defined benefit plan, there are many assumptions, and you simply can't control and eliminate risk with respect to those assumptions, such as investment earnings. We think it'll be 8%. We hope it will be 8%. We don't know if it will be 8%. Mortality. We think people will die at a certain age. I'm not going to express what the hope is. I actually hope that they live as long as possible, but that hope leads to unfunded liability if the longevity exceeds the assumptions. Inflation. We have certain expectations of inflation, but I think we're all concerned that with the incredible amount of money that governments have been pumping into economies around the world to kind of carry us through the recession, which we hope is nearly over, that at some point inflation is going to rear its head and we'll be in a higher inflationary environment that we currently project. So that's why the note is indeterminate, because we don't know.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do fiscal notes all the time, and we have things that we don't know. On oil taxes, we don't necessarily know what the price of oil will be. We don't necessarily know how many oils will go down the pipeline. And it's no different here. I mean, you have an 8% assumption that you, the ARM board, the actuary use. You have an estimate of how long people will live. Assuming everything that you know to be true, 8%, your mortality rates, what's the fiscal impact to the state? Is it positive or negative?
And so, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, if you look at the actuary letter, it does show a savings over the first X years. We concede that. We're not trying to hide it. Under the assumptions that go into the bill, there is a short-term savings.
How much?
I believe, Jesse, help me, I think it's $70
million.
68.9, close enough.
Other questions, comments? I have two that are kind of policy sorts of things. Most fields that I've worked in, which are limited, good managers are all we or should be reviewing working conditions and benefit and salary packages. And one measure of that is, are you able to get and keep qualified employees on the job? And secondly, when you have a vacancy, is there a line of people outside the door wanting that position? It's certainly been represented to me and I suspect, to my colleagues that our having gone to a defined contribution system has reduced our attractiveness as an employer, the state's attractiveness as an employer. And we've heard at least anecdotally, and one young man from my district presented some pretty compelling figures for teachers about turnover in the last few years. First of all, for the labor, state labor force in general, is there any discernible change in since we've adopted a defined contribution plan?
Mr. Chair, we did provide some trend numbers to Senator Geisel. It's not clear to me that they got to the entire committee. We'll make sure that we get those to you. They show how many employees started within the public employees retirement system and as actives in the teachers retirement system in a year certain, and then what their termination rate was over each of the successive years. I have not studied those numbers enough to draw any firm conclusions from them, but we'll provide the numbers to the entire committee, and the committee can draw its own conclusions. The state of Alaska has done a termination, or they call it an employee movement report, through FY11, and we haven't done an employee movement report since FY11. But those numbers for the state of Alaska only did not show an increase in employee termination subsequent to 2000 FY07, when the defined contribution tier went in. If anything, it showed that employees were actually leaving the state less frequently. Now, one could argue, and legitimately so, that the reason why terminations went down in that time period is that the country was in an economic recession, and it made sense to stay put in Alaska. But prior to the enactment of SB 141, which closed the defined benefit tier, Alaska experienced fairly high rates of turnover. And I think that's just the nature of Alaska. People come, people stay for a bit, and people leave. And that fairly integral feature of Alaska's workforce hasn't changed.
My second question, do the division, different divisions of the state who employ folks have a formal process by which they periodically analyze the efficacy, if you will, of our salary and benefits program and look at these trends? And come forward with suggestions of, hey, we need to boost this up here and seems to be adequate there or whatever.
Mr. Chair, the question is, do we have a formal process for doing that? And I don't know if there's a formal process within the state of Alaska, but unquestionably there's an informal process where we're constantly evaluating, constantly being asked to evaluate the fairness of our salary schedule, for instance. The fairness and adequacy of our pension benefits, for instance. I will say, for the state of Alaska only, if I could just take a moment to, because we don't get too much opportunity to do this, to identify and highlight the benefits of the existing Tier 4, the defined contribution tier. The employee contributes 8% of their income into an account that they can control. The employer for public employee retirement system contributes 5% for a total of 13%. And then we also have the supplemental annuity system, sometimes called SBS, in which the employee contributes 6.13% and the employer matches that at 6.13%. If you add all those up, you're at a contribution rate of 25.26% of an employee's salary. And over a career of contribution at that rate, the amounts add up to a fairly extraordinary amount. What it requires in a defined contribution system is for employees to remain employed for 30 to 35 years, which we would consider to be a normal working career. I think you've heard from other speakers on this bill that something less than that is a normal working career, but I'd like to submit to the committee that you can't build a sustainable retirement plan on a career of 20 years. Somebody starts when they're 25, retires when they're 45, and they get health insurance from the age 46 to age 90. Somebody starts when they're 25 and retires when they're 50, and they get health insurance until they're 80 or 90. Everywhere else in the country and the world, in the private sector, for sure, employees are expected to work 35 or 40 years, from 25 to 65. And as time goes on, from 25 to 70, certainly with time out for childbirth and raising small kids, but it's not unreasonable to expect people to work 30, 35, 40 years. And when you're building a retirement plan, you have to do that. You have to have that assumption. When you put those numbers into calculations within a defined contribution pension plan, what happens is the law of compounding returns at almost any rate of return. Now, we've submitted information that shows what happens in a 35-year career and an 8% return. You can ratchet that down to 7%, 6%, 5%, even 4% over a 35 to 40-year career. Those amounts add up to a meaningful amount, an amount that can sustain a retirement, a secure retirement. And I think I'd like to also say that the Alaska Retirement Management Board and the Division of Treasury have put together a phenomenal array of investment options. Under the U.S. Department of Labor regulations that were adopted a few years ago, folks today default into a target date fund, which is based on their age. And that target date fund is professionally managed. It's very, very cheap in terms of the costs of it. So, for instance, someone who defaults into a 2040 target date fund will pay investment and administrative expenses of 0.26%, 26 basis points. That's far, far less than the administrative costs that we pay on to our investment managers in the defined benefit plan. So it's a huge savings there. And what happens in a target date fund is the investment mix changes automatically as someone gets older. So it starts pretty aggressive when they're young, and as they get older, it gets less aggressive. More fixed income debt instruments or come in and replace the aggressive equity instruments. We've built for the state of Alaska defined contribution tier, an incredible defined contribution plan, one that if an employee remains employed with the state of Alaska for 30, 35, 40 years, will build out up to an incredible amount.
Such as?
Well, there's numbers before you. At 8% return over 35 years, $1 point something million. That's just for the defined contribution. If you add in the SBS, it roughly doubles. That's at 8%, ratchet it down to less than that, it still adds up.
All right. And as I remember, the new defined contribution also allows, transportability?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Portability,
yeah. All right. Any questions or comments? All right. Thank you, Mr. Barnes. We'll now take up, we're going to set this aside. It is honestly my anticipation this bill will not pass this year out of the legislature. I continue to be impressed with the efforts that have been put into making this happen. And I don't know who else deserves credit besides you, Fate, but you've done a good, if not a great job. Certainly, I won't be here in the future, but a significant portion of the legislature's concern is going to be the viability of the program and under what circumstances the risk devolves to the citizens of Alaska. But don't give up. Thank you, sir. We're going to set this aside and take up House Bill 310. Who's going to make the presentation? This is an act relating to the selection and duties of delegates to a convention of the states. Take a brief at ease.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 2. And before you is HB 310. And I would say the bill is a simple bill, but we know in this building there is no such thing as a simple bill. And what brought this bill forward was SJR 22, which is the Convention of the States, and how we chose the topics to have a Convention of the States. And one of the questions I received from my House members were, how do we make it so it's not a runaway convention? What can we do so that we know that the delegates will go and do the things that we ask them to do? And with that, what we did is that we now have made parameters around that convention. And you'll see in your packet there's about 15 to 20 other states who've done the same thing. And they all kind of went about it the same way, to where they'll take an oath of the office. They can be recalled at any time, and they can be recalled for not following the instructions. Those instructions will be given once a call has been given. And it can be anything from specific amendments to which topics we want our delegates to talk about. It's as close up, we can make it as tight as we would like to make it. The part that was taken on the House floor was that I had it to where if they didn't follow the instructions, they were charged with a felony. Yeah. I was really surprised that House State Affairs did not take that out, because I just really wanted to show that literally, we can make it as strong as possible. And so the first version was that we were going to send delegates. We weren't going to pay their way. We were going to tell them what to do and the oath. And if they didn't do what we said we wanted them to do, we were then going to recall them and possibly charge them with a felony. Which in your minds might be, wow. But this is very serious. We're talking about the Constitution here. And so on the House floor, they decided that maybe a felony was a little bit too strong. And I was absolutely fine with that. I just wanted to make sure they realized they had that option. I also learned that a Class C felony is basically anything that doesn't fall under A or B. So it's kind of interesting that we would have an open category for that. So that portion was changed. The other part we changed is that we made it down to two delegates. And the reason for the two delegates, again, was the felony was part of that. If we had more than two, you know, who would you blame for saying, you know, one thing or the other? But I want to remind the committee that it is one state, one vote. So it doesn't matter whether you send 50 people or you send 100, you're going to get one vote. And so we also took out to where compensation is not determined in this bill one way or the other. We figured at that time we'll know where the state stands fiscally and whether or not, you know, where it's going to be held at. So all this does now is it puts in that there's going to be two people. You have to be a resident of the state for 3 years. Of course, you have to be a registered voter, and you have to be willing to take an oath that says that you're going to follow the instructions that have been given. So with that, I'll take any questions you may have.
Yeah. Pardon me for not doing this earlier. Which version would you prefer that we have before us?
I believe it is version A.
C.A.
Is that right?
A.
Oh, C dot.
Yep.
I'm sorry, let me try that.
So without objection.
Oh, yes, yeah, backslash C. Thank you very much, Senator.
Backslash E dot C. A. Yes?
Backslash C dot A.
All right. Is objection to having backslash C dot A as our working document? Other questions, comments from the committee? I haven't had as good a chance, or I haven't taken the chance that I've had with this version. Did you take out the felony?
Mr. Chair, yes, we did.
I would have suggested a Class A misdemeanor, which is still 2 years and $10,000. A felony rap is difficult.
A little strong? I just found it interesting, Mr. Chair, that when I brought the resolution forward, the big concern really was the runaway, and then it was even more interesting to find out then they were a little upset that we went that far to make sure that it wasn't. And so one of the questions on the House floor at that time was, where did we get that information, from it? And we literally looked at all the different states. Indiana has passed it all the way through on theirs. They haven't passed the resolution, but they did this portion. But what we found with the states that now have resolutions for convention of the states, they've all gone back and made it a bill so that people understood that, that was one step. This is the second step is how we would take care and send our delegates. But then the third and really the most important part will be the legislature at that time determining, do they want the delegates to talk about all three topics? Do they want them to just kind of have a lot of free will and suggestions? Or will we send our delegates with actual amendments and they have to, sell those amendments or not? And if it goes beyond that we won't participate in it. So there's a lot of decisions to be made down the road.
Your questions, Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a reason we're appointing two delegates? Are other states doing two delegates as well? Is that the standard?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, we had more than that. We went down to two because a felony was still in it. I think you're going to see a whole lot of different numbers with it. And more of it was back to the control factor, that if there was only two versus 10, 20, it would make it much harder to be able to realize who was responsible for following the instructions. And I'm not tied to that number whatsoever. That was kind of the number that the state affairs on the House side determined because, again, we had a pretty strong penalty.
To continue.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm just wondering if we're tying our hands behind our backs, if other states are sending 10 delegates or 15 delegates, if we want to lock ourselves into two.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I have no issues even taking that part and making that determination as part of the instructions. Again, it was more just showing my colleagues that they really did get to determine every part of this convention as far as our delegates go. And again, to reiterate that no matter how many you send, you still just get one vote. But I think there's good on both sides of having just a few, or again, if at that time in the instructions they determine they're going to give more free will and allow them to have more discussion, you might want more than two because somebody would probably, like you see here in this building, have to go around to the other states and give your pitch. And with two, that may limit you. So I am not tied to that number. It was just more of, here's what we have. And states right now kind of are all over the board as far as how many there are.
Representative Wilson, this whole process has been very intriguing. But I think in order to get to a convention, just get there, that there's got to be convergence on the subject of it and something about the nature of it, and so on. But I think having varying numbers of delegates, as long as there's only one vote per state, wouldn't exclude us. Is that a correct assumption?
That's true, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
The number of delegates you send has no impact on any of the rest of it.
Yeah, and it's been kind of my goal, knowing there's two or three major groups in the nation that are working on this process with some communication between them, but some different perspectives. And it is at least for a default for me to be fine with sending forth a couple, three different ones so that we're in the queue, if you will, no matter what happens. Is that a reasonable assumption for me to be making?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I want to also bring your attention that it's two delegates and two alternates, because if somebody were to be recalled, so I would think you'd want to keep the numbers you know, similar to that, because the last thing you want to have happen is that you recall your delegate and then you have no one to represent what you would like to see.
Senator Wilkowski?
Just reading from an email I got from a frequent comment testifier here, Mike Goons, but he's also the regional director for the Citizens Initiative. He says, page 2, lines 8 through 12, and I'll just read it if I could, Mr. Chair. If a rule or a procedure established by a convention of the states called by a two-thirds vote of the state legislatures under Article 5, Constitution of the United States, is different than the procedure established under this section, selection of the delegates shall comply with rule or procedure established by constitutional convention, and the delegates shall comply with AS 1550-130. This is abdicating our state sovereignty. Do you have any comment on that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I talked to Mr. Coons this morning, and what he's proposing in his resolution is a little bit different than this one is. And that's what's really kind of, it's great because we've got a lot of grassroots going on right now and everybody getting excited about being able to be part of that, but with that comes a lot of confusion about what each one of these does. And so I asked, you know, we had the discussion whether he was okay with the language, and he said that if he wasn't, he would call in today and better explain his position.
And he is online.
So I'm glad I said it in those words.
He had another comment, and I'll let him discuss his comment number three, Mr. Chair, when he gets a chance.
Yeah. Mike is not only very active on this, on several issues, but actually is a bit of a friend in my district, I believe, and has gathered and garnered credibility with me. Mike, we're running out of time here, and we'll have a choice here in a couple, 3 minutes or four, whether to pass this bill on or not, or hold it over for another couple of days. So, Mike, please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, this is Mike Coons, and I am from Palmer, and I'm speaking as the Regional Director for Citizens Initiatives. I support the intent of this bill, just to say out of the top, but I do have some concerns. But the two delegates, if the bill is passed when the Convention of the States called, there is now, I don't believe, really any latitude with others, when other states in large numbers, as to section, as to page 2, lines 8 through 12, that Senator Wilkowski was talking about. I also, he just stopped it. This is abdicating our state sovereignty. What I said further is this is making it so that the convention is potentially making the convention a deliberative body, not the state legislature. And that this opens the door for large states to make the rules, and we would then follow them under this section. Third is page 2, lines 13 through 7, which we're talking about the convening of the convention, providing for instructions for the delegates. What is the intention of those instructions? Will those instructions be amendments approved by the legislature, as Representative Wilson was talking about? That is a distinct potential. Will those... Ohio, Michigan, and Georgia now have passed a call for a convention of the states to propose a balanced budget amendment. This is a single-issue amendment only, thus this language opens the door to different topics that the delegates could consider. There are some serious questions about that are being raised that we now have 34 or more states making this call for a BBA. The Congress could make this call this year or at the latest next year. And if they don't, the states still have the right to convene. In closing, from the standpoint of codifying the criminal aspect of the delegates violate their oath, I have no problem with it. However, this bill is just one part of the issue. To maintain the sovereignty of the state of Alaska, we must have a delegate resolution that not only binds the delegates, but ensures that under Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, that there is indeed one state, one vote, language that lays out the rules of the convention in advance, and a pre-approved amendment. Citizens Initiative is working hard to be the facilitator to the state legislatures as to the resolution and the amendment so that the majority of the states all had the same language prior to the convention. I have sent to members of this committee, the sponsor, and others our proposed delegate resolution, which will ensure a safe, efficient, and concise convention. If any would like to see this, please let me know. Thank you.
Questions? Comments? Mike Dyson. If we pass this bill in this legislature, will that preclude a subsequent one cleaning up and altering the issues that you have put on the table?
I don't believe we have the ability to, as Representative Wilson and I talked about today, what this bill here does is it put some teeth into the delegates as far as your ability to recall them, and that I have absolutely no problem with. As we talked about, and I think you and I have talked about, is that with this delegate resolution, that would further define how that convention would be run, and if we have 26 states or more, all with that same delegate resolution or something very similar to it, then those 26, then we have a majority of the states controlling that convention. Thus, the states like New York and Illinois and California and Massachusetts, the more liberal, large, populous states, couldn't come in and turn around and try to run roughshod over the smaller population states. So I think there's definite steps on the way, and as regional director for Citizens Initiative will work closely with you guys so that we can
I think you said no, that this action won't preclude fixing things in the future. Any questions, Mike? Mike, thanks for weighing in. Enjoy a chance to have a cup of coffee after I get home and settled. All right. The chair will entertain a motion.
Do you need to close public testimony?
Sorry? We'll close public testimony. Chair, I'll entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for House Bill number 310, State Affairs Amended, version 28, LS0991/Charlie Alpha from this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Objection? Seeing none, House Bill 310 moves committee with individual recommendations, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.